So I used to teach high school English. I think you all know that. When I taught 8th grade, 9th grade, 11th grade. When I taught my 9th graders, freshmen, first year of high school, and the 9th graders were day one of their first year of high school. They come in and they were not ready for high school. At least a lot of them were not. Some were, but most of them were not ready for high school. And I would get questions like, "You mean we have homework every night?" Yes. What did you expect? You mean you're going to quiz us over our readings? Yes. Why would I not? I got this kind of stuff just all the time. And it was like shock. And really all they were doing was going to high school. I mean, you look at it, you all have been through high school. You've been through much more than high school. And you look back at that and think, oh, that's no big deal. But to them, it was shock coming in and having to do homework every night and having to read and be quizzed over their readings the next day and so on. I imagine there's a lot of that kind of thing in law school, you know? What's that?
In every kind of school.
Yeah, that's right. Or coming to America. You come to America and you're expecting, and you find out that what you were expecting, well, America's not quite that way. And there's a certain amount of shock at America when you come from another culture and you come here and you just weren't ready for it. But many people who come to America think it's dreamland. And then they get here and they're not ready for some of the things they have to deal with in America. Now, what if my freshman, first day of class, could have been forewarned that this is what high school is like? Would that have helped?
If they listened.
If they listened. That's right. Or what if immigrants coming to America could be told about what America really is like before they got here? Now, would that remove all the difficulties? Nope. But would it help you be ready when you came? Yeah, it would. Okay, something like that is going on in Daniel today, in what we're going to read in chapter 8. Daniel is going to sort of forewarn the Jewish people of some stuff that's going to come. And so, what I'm going to do is read, and we're actually going to read the whole chapter. I don't really like reading 27 verses in one sitting, because it's, you sort of come sometimes lose your focus, but it's all one thing, and it's hard to break it up. So you're just going to have to hang with me while I read these verses, and you can join us. We're in Daniel 8, starting at verse 1. It says, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased, and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great, even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end." And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now." And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business. But I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. Okay. he sees this vision. And it really impacted him.
Okay, so he's out walking around when this happens, right?
It doesn't say where he is when he has the vision.
Okay, I thought it did.
No. He's in the vision, he is in the city of Susa by the Ulai Canal. But that's part of the vision. That's not where he physically is.
Okay. Sorry.
No, that's okay. But he's gotten this vision that has come from God. And it has been so overpowering that he's actually sick. And I mean, you know, God, we think God speaks and, oh yeah, everybody wants God to speak. And, but you know, when you come face to face with, and he's got Gabriel here, you know, angels and God and whatnot, it's a pretty significant thing. God is no light matter. Message from him. Okay, verse 1 gives us when this happens. It is the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. This is between 545 and 550 BC. We don't know the exact year, but somewhere in there. This is 2 years after the dream that he had in chapter 7. And he refers to that dream in verse 1. A vision appeared to me after that which appeared to me at the first. That's the first dream he had in chapter 7. And he's got this vision. In the vision, he is in the city of Susa by the Ulai Canal. Susa was the capital of the province of Elam, which is not in Babylon. It was in Persia. It actually became the royal city. There were royal palaces, and it was the summer, actually it might be the winter, administration headquarters for the Persian Empire, which under Belshazzar doesn't exist yet, at least in Daniel's realm. And so Persia has not yet taken over Babylon, but he's probably been to Susa for government business, and so he knows what it looks like. And in his vision, that's where he is. And he's got a vision of these animals that represent kingdoms. We've seen that before. And horns that represent kings. And that should sound familiar from chapter 7. And so verses 3 and 4, we get the first animal. And there's this ram in Susa, which is the capital city of the Persian Empire, is going to be the capital city of the Persian Empire. And this ram has two horns. And one horn becomes greater than the other horn. And the ram charges north and south and west and conquers everything. And the vision tells us who the ram is in verse 20, when Gabriel shows up. And so you learn that this ram is the kings of Media and Persia, which, you know, two horns, one's Media, one's Persia, but one ram. It was one empire. It wasn't two empires. It was one empire made up of two peoples that came and united, and one horn grew greater than the other horn in the dream, which is what happened in history, because the Persians came to dominate the Medes. And it eventually became known as the Persian Empire. And so that's his dream. He has his dream of this is what he sees. Then, verses 5 through 8, it says, as he's considering the ram, here comes a goat. And the goat is coming from the west, and he's not touching the ground, which means he's probably coming pretty quick from the west. And he has one horn between his eyes, a great horn between his eyes. And the goat charges the ram at Susa. He breaks the ram's horns and crushes the ram. And there is nothing the ram can do against that goat. No one can rescue the ram. The great horn on the goat then breaks off, and four horns grow on the goat in four to the four winds of heaven, you know, north, south, east, west. That's the idea. Now, the vision tells us who the goat is in verses 21 and 22. And it says, verse 21, and the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. So the first king of the Greek Empire was Alexander the Great. And Greece, of course, is to the west of Persia. And so from the west comes the goat very rapidly, and Alexander's armies, that was there. They were like Blitzkrieg before Blitzkrieg exist. That's what that was how they conquered. And so that was their modus operandi, is they were like lightning. And within like 3 years, Alexander had conquered pretty much the Persian Empire. Persia couldn't stand against him. And they were trampled to the ground, and no one could rescue Persia from Alexander's hand. And then it says, verse 22, as for the horn that was broken in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. So after Alexander, this is just history, after Alexander conquered Persia, he died shortly thereafter, within, I can't remember how many years, but it was a short time, like within 3 years or something of conquering all of that land, Alexander died. And then there was a lot of fights over who gets the empire, and Alexander's two sons were murdered, and the empire wound up being divided four ways amongst four of Alexander's generals. And there was a north and a south and an east and a west empire. It was all part of the original Greek empire, but it was divided four ways, and you had four different empires that often wound up fighting one another over lots of things in the history that would come later. But that's what he's seeing. Daniel's seeing this in a vision before it's going to happen. But it's all symbol. It's horns and goats and rams and, you know, charging and conquering. And he doesn't know names, but that's what he sees in his vision. Now, in chapter 7, when Daniel had the dream of the four kingdoms that came, the dream really focused in on the last kingdom. He didn't spend a whole lot of time on the others. That was Rome. This vision focuses in on that third kingdom, Greece. And so this vision is really going to focus on that empire, the empire that began with Alexander the Great, was divided by four generals, north, south, east, west, and we get more details. And so it says this, so Greece is divided into four kingdoms, and out of one of those, verse 9, so out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And verse 23, this little horn, it says, at the latter end of their kingdom, that's the kingdom of the four kings, at the latter end, so toward the end of the reign of these four kingdoms, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. So he's saying that toward the end of the reign of these four kings, some king is going to arise. The vision tells us when this king comes. It's toward the end of the latter reign of these four divided kingdoms. It also tells us what he's going to do. So I'm just going to kind of walk through the text and kind of show you what the text says about what, in the vision, what is this king going to do? So, here's what he's going to do, verses 9 and 10 and verse 24. He's going to grow really strong. So there's a little horde and grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, toward the glorious land. It grew great, even to the host of heaven. Verse 24, that king who arises, his power shall be great, but not by his own power. And so he's gonna be really powerful, this king that's going to arise. Verse 9, he's going to have power over the glorious land. That would be Palestine. From Daniel's perspective, that's the glorious land. And so this king's going to have, when the king, of the four divided kings, this one's going to have power over that region. Verses 10, 11, and 24, he's going to persecute the people of God. So some of the host of heaven, he's going against the stars, he's trampling on them, he becomes great, even as great as the prince of the host. He's taking away the regular burnt offering. Verse 24, he's going to destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. So this king that's going to come, he's going to basically persecute God's people. Verses 11 and 13, he's going to take away the regular burnt offering at the sanctuary. And by the way, from Daniel's perspective, this is almost like a backhanded encouragement. Because Daniel is in exile in Babylon and the temple is destroyed when Daniel has this vision. And so for him to have a vision of the future when the burnt offering in the temple is going to end must mean that, oh, the temple is coming back. We're going back to the land. And so it's like encouragement, but persecution, all at the same time. And so this king is going to take away the regular burnt offering in the sanctuary. Verses 11 and 13, he's going to overthrow the temple. Verse 12, he throws truth to the ground, this king. Verse 25, he operates by deceit. Verses 11 and 25, he's going to rise up against God himself. That's the prince of princes. He's going to take a stand against God himself. Verse 24, he is going to cause fearful destruction and destroy many people, including God's people. Verse 14, how long will he do these things? For about 2,300 evenings and mornings, about 2,300 days. That's about 6 years and 4 months. Okay, so let me just kind of put all that together and summarize it. Here's what this vision is saying about this guy. In the latter part of the divided Greek kingdom, a king is going to arise in the south and the east to include the regions of Palestine. The king is going to have great power. He's going to make war on God, on God's people, on God's sanctuary, and on the offerings that are offered at the temple. He's going to operate by deception, and he's going to kill many of God's people. Okay, that's the vision that he has. Now, did this happen?
Didn't Alexander do something in the temple?
What's that?
Didn't somebody come in and desecrate the temple?
Yes, this did happen.
I asked him about it.
And so this vision really ends with a Greek king named Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV. And he reigned over the region of Palestine from about 175 to 163 BC. So that's about, 380 years into the future from Daniel. But it's in the past for us. He declared himself God manifest in the flesh. That's how he got the name Epiphanes. That's a nickname. It was on his coins. and it means manifest. And it that didn't mean literally that he probably believed himself to be that. It was probably more like he believed himself to be God's representative here on earth, and you have to listen to me. That's the emperors, that's kind of how emperors did things back then.
It helps to keep the people in control.
It does. He inflicted some of the most severe persecution on the Jewish people in history. And so, and they've had some pretty severe persecution. And certainly in biblical times, it's some of the most severe. You know, you could talk about Pharaoh and what went on there, and that maybe that's worse, or I don't know. I don't really want to compare. But the fact of the matter is, this guy was pretty nasty. He put an end to the sacrifices in the temple. He made them illegal. He built an altar to Zeus in the temple and sacrificed a pig on the altar. Now, think what that's going to do to a Jew. Oof. Oh, my. It's like, okay, he actually caused a war by doing that. And he forbade the observance of the dietary laws. He forbade observance of the Sabbath. He forbade observance of circumcision. He forbade observance of keeping the Jewish feasts, of making the sacrifices and the offerings. And all this was illegal. Anyone who was found practicing any of these things was executed. And he burned the books of the law. If anyone was found with any kind of scripture, he was executed. And whatever was found was burned. He commanded everyone to follow the Greek gods and himself. He slaughtered thousands of Jews, and from the time he murdered the high priest Onias to the time when the temple was eventually rededicated, it was from about 170 BC when he murdered Onias to December 14th, 164 BC, when that was the day the temple was rededicated, was about 6 years and a few months, or pretty close to 2300 evenings and mornings.
Yeah.
Okay, Daniel is seeing a picture of this. That's what he's seeing in his vision. He's seeing it about 380 years before it happened. And in verse 27, he says, "I did not understand it." And you understand why. He doesn't understand it. He may have had a broad idea that at some point in the future, there's some king that's going to come and he's going to be nasty. You know, he may have had an idea like that based on his dream. But he doesn't know who this king is. He doesn't know that this king is going to come and set up an altar to Zeus in the temple and sacrifice a pig on the altar. He doesn't know the policies of Antiochus. He just has a broad picture of a king in the distant future who's going to wreak havoc with God's people. And it's going to put an end to the sacrifices. How that plays out, he has no idea. He doesn't know what this... This is history that he hasn't seen. We can look back on it and see, oh my, look at this, and kind of see what God was doing. This is how the prophets are a lot of times. Most of the time when the prophets see something in the future, they actually don't understand what they're seeing. Which is all the more reason why it's from God. It didn't come from them. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand it. It couldn't have... Daniel didn't just come up with this. Okay, so when you look at this, you should see, first of all, that history is in God's hand. I mean, Daniel's getting history before it happens from God, as if God knows what's going to happen. God knows the end from the beginning. God declares the end of the indignation of Antiochus, that's verse 19 when he's talking about that, 380 years before Antiochus reigned. And God's hand is in it. You should also see that God is predicting the suffering of his people. His people are going to suffer. And he tells them in advance that this is coming. Even if they don't fully understand it, and they wouldn't. None of the Jews would have understood this until after the fact, looking back and said, oh, this was Antiochus. Afterwards, they could recognize it and put it together. But beforehand, they wouldn't know who this was. But God's telling them that in advance, that they're going to suffer. And he does that for us, too. I mean, think of Paul in Philippians. Philippians 1:29 says this, "For it has been granted to you for the sake of Christ that you, not only should you believe in his name, but that you will suffer for his sake." In other words, it's been granted to you to suffer for him. It's going to happen, is what that is. He's saying in advance, you should just expect it. This is normal. That's a promise. You know how we like to hold on to the promises? This is one of those promises that we don't necessarily want to hold on to. Because you have been promised you're going to experience hardship and difficulty and suffering for the sake of Christ. That's just a promise. And Daniel's vision, in a sense, is also a promise. It's a promise of something that's coming in the future. And it involves severe suffering for the people of God. God's saying through Daniel, this is what's coming. Now, that promise of suffering is kind of hidden in symbol and a vision, and you don't maybe understand it all, but it's just as much a promise of suffering as Philippians 1:29 is. "For it has been granted unto you for the sake of Christ, not only to believe in his name, but also to suffer for his sake." Now, when God gives Daniel a picture of the future, of what's coming, he does it because he loves his people. He wants to prepare them for what's coming, for the hardship that awaits them. He doesn't want his people to just think, oh, I follow God, everything's going to be wonderful now. He wants his people to know that if you follow him, you can expect this world to oppose you. Just expect it. And sometimes to violently oppose you. Maybe, you know, here in America we don't face that, but outside America, people face that today all the time for their faith. Our opposition takes different forms here in America. But nonetheless, violence against Christians is it's actually pretty normal worldwide. And God wants his people to see this as normal. He doesn't want you to be surprised when hardship comes, when suffering comes, when persecution comes. He doesn't want you to say, oh man, why? Why would they do that? Well, because they're from the world. That's why they would do that. That's what the world does. And he wants you prepared for it as much as possible. Now, will you be fully prepared when the suffering comes? No. It'll still be hard. Will it help to actually expect it? Yeah, it will. it's helpful to not be surprised when it comes. It helps to know that this is normal. I can expect to suffer if I stand for Christ. And when I do, there's nothing wrong with me. Because sometimes we think that, right? Oh, I must have done something wrong to, well, maybe you did something right to get that reaction. You know what else helps in the midst of this is to know that God is bigger than history. That God is sovereign. That God sits on his throne even when you suffer. He's there. And it's okay. It helps to know that in the midst of your pain, that God is with you. And that God may allow his people to suffer and even die. But that the suffering is worth going through for the sake of Christ. And there's another thing that helps when you go through it. And that is that there's justice. That helps to know that. In the end, those who persecute will be judged. They're not going to get away with it. They won't. There's no such thing in the Bible as ultimate injustice. There is injustice on earth, but injustice on earth is not ultimate. Ultimately, there's justice. And that's comforting to people who suffer. The people who really appreciate justice the most are the people who suffer. And that's helpful to know. And so the sovereign God brings Antiochus to an end. And it says he's going to come to an end, not by human hands, it says in the vision. And Antiochus actually died by a disease in the end, not by human hands. And God does that, ultimately, with all people who oppose Christ and oppose the gospel. They're going to come to an end. And they're going to ultimately be judged. You know, last chapter we had that great judgment that went on, and that great judgment's real. So all this is stuff that you need to understand when you walk through difficulty. Because hardship, even death, if it comes to it, is worth it for Christ. So, let's sort of summarize some of this now. God wants us to know, as his people, that if we follow Jesus, the world is going to oppose us. It just is. It's going to fight you. It's going to stand against you. It's going to maybe even hate you. Jesus used those words concerning the world. And that fact is so, you can bank on that fact. Just expect it. The world's going to oppose you. It is. Jesus said, it's John 15, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you too. So Jesus said. Jesus said, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, in Matthew 5. Jesus told his disciples, beware of men, for they will deliver you over to courts and flog you in their synagogues, and you will be dragged before governors and kings, for my sake, in Matthew 10. Peter writes, do not be surprised at the fiery trial that comes upon you, as if something strange were happening to you. That's how Peter puts it. In other words, guys, it's all throughout. I quoted Paul earlier. We got Peter, we got Paul, we got Jesus, and we could keep going with this idea. In other words, suffering and hardship are normal. Why would you be surprised when it happens? Does it make sense? Why would you be surprised? It's normal. And so here's the thing. You will experience it in some form or fashion. I'm not saying that you're going to face prison or you're going to face, you know, being executed for your faith like the Jews under Antiochus did. But you will face opposition from this world. And if you follow Jesus, Jesus guarantees you hardship. But when you suffer, God is with you. There's no difficulty that can take you from the presence of Jesus. Nothing can separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? We're more than conquerors. In all of these things, we're more than conquerors through Him who loved us. When Paul writes that in Romans 8, he assumes that his readers will experience tribulation and distress and persecution and famine and nakedness and danger and sword. He says that in all of these things, you're more than conquerors, which means he's actually expecting you to go through all of those things. And so, but then he says, in those things, we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. In those things, we are still one with Christ. In those things, we still experience the love of God. See, those things don't take away the love of God. Those things are a greater reason for us to hold on to the love of God. And God is with us in the midst of them. Sometimes we use danger and distress and tribulation and hardship, and we use all this stuff as excuses to disobey God or deny Him or hide Him, and there's no peace in that. But you know where there is peace? It's when we have faith that if we obey Jesus against the world, Jesus is still with us. He's not going to leave you. Even if you go to prison, He's not going to leave you. Even if your family, you know, does things against you for your faith because you took a stand on something and they just, you know, critique you or whatever it happens to be, they stand against you, He's still with you. He doesn't go anywhere. There's peace when we do that. It's when we know that standing for Jesus will bring pain, but we stand anyway. There's peace in that. That is a central theme of 1 Peter, of the entire book of 1 Peter. That's one of the central themes. Now, Daniel 8, God is telling His people that in the future, you're going to go through the fire, guys. But He's also telling them that that fire is limited. 2,300 evenings and mornings.
That's a gift.
That's right. So it's going to last a little more than 6 years. And He's also telling them that they're going to outlast their persecutors. He's going to come to an end, but not by human hands, it says in the vision. And we as God's people need to see all of that. We need to see not just the suffering, but the whole package that comes, you know, that God is communicating to us in the midst of all of that. That we need to see that God allows us to suffer. We need to see that God is with us when we suffer. We need to see that God takes us through the suffering. Now, I want to do this. I'm going to close. I want to talk about... Actually, I'm not going to talk. I'm going to show a video. Just an example from the persecuted church. The church around the world is persecuted. And I think it's sometimes good for us in America to see something of what's going on around the world outside of our little world, and to understand that the kinds of things the Bible talks about are very real today. It's not just Antiochus in the 160s BC. It's the kinds of stuff Antiochus did, it goes on all over the place today. And sometimes we just need to see that. And so I'm going to close with that. I'm going to show a video, and then I'm going to ask us just to have a time to pray for the persecuted church.